Hello, you're listening to Romeo And, a podcast about masculinities, nice guys, sexism, and what it means to be a man in our society today. I'm your host, Street Saint. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Twitch. Twitch is a video sharing site similar to YouTube, but it caters specifically to people who are live streaming while playing video games. If this idea is completely new to you, then yes, it does sound pretty nerdy. But the site is viewed by millions of gamers every day and has earned so much money that Amazon bought the site for like a gajillion dollars. No joke, it was pretty insane. But a lot of gamers were worried about the new ownership, especially when Twitch sent out this announcement that said that they were going to be instituting a more strict dress policy. Sounds like we're in high school or something, but naturally, with an audience of primarily teen to young adult men who sit at home and watch others play video games, some business-savvy women decided to try and capitalize on this growing video streaming industry. And we saw more and more women take to Twitch wearing low-cut tops, showing off their cleavage while playing popular video games. Now, a few interesting things happened as a result of this. First off, most of these women didn't become nearly as successful as you might imagine. And here's why. Because it's not enough to take off your clothes in front of a camera. If you think it's that easy to be a porn star, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but no. Just like any other industry, you have people who are good at their job, people who are great at their job, and people who should probably think about getting into another line of work. Sure, if you have big boobs and you're willing to show them off, you're certainly going to earn yourself a lot of attention. But you can't make money on Twitch if people are just clicking on your channel to ogle at your tits just to leave a minute later for something more interesting. What separates your show from the countless others you can find on Twitch? What games do you play? Who are you playing with? What do you have to say about those games? What is your sound quality like? What kind of camera are you using? What are your social media links? Facebook, Twitter, YouTube? How often do you update them? How often, how long, and how regularly do you stream? These are just a small handful of the things you're going to have to consider when you're trying to build a successful channel. And once a lot of these women realized that it wasn't as simple as it was cracked up to be, they gave it up. Turns out, just because you're attractive doesn't mean it's easy to maintain a successful business. Go figure. But something else that happened on Twitch as a result of this influx of cam girls, as they are called, is the conversations and arguments that arose because of it. A lot of people became upset when the cam girls joined Twitch. Twitch was supposed to be about video games, and the cam girls were there to take advantage of the hormones of young men and boys. And I agreed with the people who made this argument. There are plenty of places to do a cam show. If you want to effectively take your clothes off for money, why not go cam on a site specifically designed for that kind of content, and leave Twitch for the video game nerds? However, there are others who were making a slightly different argument. Others were upset with the cam girls because they took away from or otherwise undermined the professional gamers and streamers, who legitimately should be gaining the notoriety of the Twitch community. This argument I had some issues with. I agreed that Twitch was for gamers, and so professionals should be gaining the most traffic. Where I took issue with these arguments is when they argued that the cam girls undermined other streamers. As if the cam girls were stealing their viewers from other streams, or what they were doing was unethical, lazy, or manipulative. First of all, as I said, camming is a business just like any other. If you suck at what you do, you won't retain an audience. Only a small part of it is looking really good. A lot more goes into it than that. Just showing off some cleavage isn't enough to build a successful channel. That's just advertising. You can have a company with a kick-ass marketing department, but if the actual product doesn't work, no one is going to give you their money. As a result, none of these channels ever make it to the top viewed channels on Twitch. Those spots are, in fact, saved for the gamers and streamers who run a professional channel. And that doesn't mean there aren't any female streamers. Unfortunately, this rise of the cam girl has muddied the playing field a bit. A lot of people now see female streamers as all just cam girls and all just trying to attract boys with their cleavage. And I've talked about it on the show before of you can't really criticize a lot of women for being attractive and doing what they do because being attractive is a marketing tool. As sexist and unethical as it might sound, that's what it comes down to. And part of that is just goes along with running a successful stream, but part of that is utilizing the fact that you are female and a lot of the viewers you will end up getting are heterosexual males. So you can't really criticize them too harshly for that because, I mean, hey, like, you have an opportunity to get a leg up in some way. You're not just gonna ignore that. You know, this is the society that we live in. Guys are sex-crazed maniacs, so if showing a little cleavage is gonna get somebody to watch your channel, then, I mean, if you're willing to do that, then who can really criticize you for that? So long as your channel is actually something interesting and different and something that people will actually enjoy watching and not just a sex show, which is something that you can't do on Twitch anyway, I don't think of it as a matter of keeping the integrity of Twitch by banning all female streamers from dressing nice. It's one of those tough balances. You can't necessarily say all female streamers are guilty of this, but at the same time, as a female streamer, to a certain extent, you're gonna want to use the fact that you are female to draw a certain amount of viewers. I mean, you don't have to, but if you've got it, flaunt it, right? But in addition to all of that, a lot of people have been pointing to the cam girls as, in a way, undermining other female streamers, like the legitimate female streamers who actually have a good video game stream. So the fact of the matter is, a lot of, if not most, female streamers on Twitch have been the victims of harassment. No surprises there. This is the internet after all. Guys thinking these girls are just on to entice young men with their bodies come onto these channels and demand to see cleavage. Tits or get out! And the like. And some people have attributed this behavior to the presence of cam girls on Twitch. If these girls weren't here showing their boobs for viewers, they say, then the legitimate female streamers wouldn't have to deal with this harassment. Now, I agree with this to an extent, but I think it misses some key points. The fact that cam girls exist on Twitch doesn't make other female gamers any more likely to be harassed. That harassment is, unfortunately, very familiar. If you are a woman with any presence online, men are going to say sexist things to you. That's just kind of a given. To blame it on the cam girls is like saying women who wear short skirts are the reason all women get catcalled on the street. Yes, seeing women wearing flattering clothing will drive men to distraction. But this is indicative of a larger problem with our socialization of young boys and men. And if you listen to the last episode, I explained the whole reason for catcalling in the first place. So maybe go back and listen to that. So yes, catcalling is a problem, but the problem doesn't lie with the women online. Everybody by now is familiar with the term victim blaming, and some people think we overuse it, but it needs to be said, you can't just blame the victim when these things happen. Even if you can legitimately say that the victim is in part to blame, they're the ones getting harassed and victimized, so clearly they're not the only ones to blame. But off of that, the people who make this argument seem to overlook how infrequently this kind of harassment occurs on Twitch. Compared to other more open forms like YouTube, Twitch and its niche gamer audience doesn't seem to have much of a problem with harassment. And when it occurs, every streamer and every moderator is going to shut down the behavior immediately. These harassers are shunned and muted and banned from the community. No, these comments shouldn't be present in the first place, but they are handled quickly and effectively, at least in my experience. Naturally, I'm not a female streamer, so I can't speak directly to the frequency or severity of the harassment, but it never seems to be a problem for streamers to filter it out of their chat rooms. And it's not like the cam girls are encouraging this behavior on their channels. They're just as vigilant about filtering out sexist comments as any other female streamer, because no one wants to deal with ignorant, sexist bullcrap. So I think it's wrong to say that cam girls are encouraging negative behaviors. I talked about porn on the show before, and the same can be said about camming. The whole market is changing. Nowadays, it all depends on how it's done and how one interacts with one's audience. In general, negative, sexist, hateful, and bullying speech has no place in these newer media channels. It's actually pretty great to see how much we've developed as a community. But we still have a long way to go. There's still a lot of backlash and pushback against what some people call the feminist agenda. And some seem to think that everything is just fine and dandy how it is. Sure, teenagers and young adults who are the prevalent consumers of these media tend to be more immature and less likely to filter their speech, but that still can't fully excuse poor behavior, because we are products of our upbringing. I always think about it this way. We sometimes excuse people, especially celebrities, when they're caught saying hateful or inappropriate things, so long as they're doing it when they're drunk. Because inebriation can lower your brain's natural filters. It's not entirely fair to punish someone for saying something they didn't actually mean to say, but you're never going to say something you don't think. No matter how drunk or high you get me, I would never spontaneously say something anti-Semitic. I would never say anything bad about the Irish or the Polish. I know that for certain because never once in my upbringing did I ever hear anything bad about any of these communities. I never once said or even thought anything negative about them because I never saw them as stereotypically one way or the other. The fact that you might say something negative about a group of people, even if it is when you're drunk, says something about your upbringing and education. Of course, having such an upbringing doesn't automatically make you a bad person. But if someone is joking about women or homosexuals or any group of people in a negative way, it means we still have work to do in eliminating these harmful stereotypes from our cultural mindset. But what do you think? Will enforcing a dress code do more good or harm in promoting a more positive experience for streamers on Twitch? Send me your thoughts. #RomeoAnd. This week, I'll be sharing another personal story about my continued dating failures. That's coming up next here on Romeo And. The circus has been a huge part of my life for the past 8 years or so. And before I decided to commit to this new undertaking of starting a production company, I spent most of my time training and teaching the circus arts. I loved every minute of it, and I've been really torn about transitioning away from that path. However, I felt I could do more good and help more people by staying true to my roots as a writer and philosopher. So that's why I created this podcast, Romeo and. And that's why I'm putting all my effort into making it the best show that I can. That said, a lot of my experiences came directly from running away and joining the circus life. And I learned a lot from all of the experience I've gained in the circus. And so today's story is going to be about an experience I had with another circus person. It's another story about being a so-called nice guy, or if you listen to the last episode, a Baxter, and discovering a huge discrepancy in how two people have come to identify their relationship. If you're a guy like me, who has been in this situation many times before, where you believe one thing about your relationship with another person, and then come to discover that they see you in a completely different way, then you'll probably identify with the story I'm about to share. If you want to follow along with the story, or just read it in your own time, you can find it on my blog at stsaint.com. That's stsaint.com/podcast. You have to be registered on the site to get to the story, but it's absolutely free and takes about 10 seconds. Once you're registered on the site, you'll be able to read the full story there. The story is entitled, For the Love of Flying Trapeze. When you work in the arts, not only do you have to be creative about the work you produce, you often have to be creative in the ways you can get paid as well. I found my breakthrough in flying trapeze. In order to keep my circus dreams alive, I wanted a job that could keep me in the industry while I kept up my training. Teaching flying trapeze is probably the most consistent and reliable way to make money for a circus geek like me. I was never a particularly big fan of the flying trapeze. Instead, I gravitated more towards ground acrobatic acts like tumbling, trampoline, and teeterboard. However, I learned that flying trapeze is and has pretty much always been the most popular attraction in the circus. And I was good enough at it to teach it to all the tourists and fans who wanted to learn, so I managed to get hired as an instructor. Soon afterwards, I found that I loved teaching trapeze way more than I could ever love watching it or doing it myself. One day working on the job, I met a girl named Lisa. Lisa was a big circus fan, but she loved all kinds of performance, from straight plays to musical theater to dance. She loved the performance world so much, she too entered the industry for a living. Although not as a performer or teacher, but as a sound technician. She worked on a number of shows and performances, and eventually her career led her to the Big Apple Circus. While doing sound and watching the show every night, she got the trapeze bug. And as a result of this budding love for trapeze, every week while the show was in town, Lisa came to my trapeze school to take classes. I looked forward to seeing her every time she came in. The two of us hit it off right away. I asked her about working with the Big Apple, and she asked me about trapeze. I had a great time with her, but I never dared to ask her out, mainly because I was too timid, but also because I knew she would only be in town for so long before packing up and getting back on the road. And so, just as many acquaintances I met at the trapeze school did, eventually Lisa disappeared from our class roster, and I was forced to wonder, what if? I wish that I had at least gotten her contact information. I couldn't even friend her on Facebook because I didn't know her last name. I regretted not at least getting a way to keep in touch with her. Although that's often how it goes in the circus world. Eventually people find themselves working on different shows, and suddenly you're living on the opposite side of the world of your best friend or lover. But the nice thing about the circus is that eventually people tend to drift back together just as they drifted apart. And so, several months later, I saw a familiar face in one of my classes. Once again, the Big Apple Circus was in town, and so once again, Lisa was back to take classes. As if she had never left, the two of us picked up our conversations right where we left off. Unfortunately, Lisa told me that her current trip back to the city would be short-lived, and she and the rest of the circus would be back on the road at the end of the week. Once again, I panicked. I wanted to ask her on a date, but it didn't seem to make much sense if she wasn't going to be around much longer. But I couldn't bear to see her leave again without at least having some way to keep in touch. I figured I should ask for her phone number, but I knew doing so would be pointless, as I would never have gathered the confidence to call her. Instead, I asked Lisa if she was on Facebook. She said she was, and so we exchanged Facebook info. It seemed like a much more practical option for me, and Lisa seemed happy to have a way to reach me, so I took it as a win. To my surprise, it was much more of a win than I had anticipated. That evening, I logged into Facebook to look up Lisa's profile. To my surprise, I already had a message sitting in my inbox. Beside Lisa's avatar was a simple, "Hey." Feeling lightheaded, I quickly sat down to avoid fainting. I know the two of us had been friendly with each other, and I know Lisa did seem to like me, but it was always a shock to receive any kind of unsolicited attention from a woman. Not sure what else to say, I simply responded with, "Hey, what's up?" For the next hour, Lisa and I sent messages back and forth. We talked about our lives, the circus, and our other interests. When I got too late, we went to bed and picked up the conversation right where we left off in the morning. And then the next day. And throughout the week. Until at the very end of the week, we started another conversation at 8 p.m., which continued well past 3 a.m. the next morning. Eventually, we decided that we needed to sleep. However, the moment we both woke up at 9 a.m. the very next morning, we continued our conversation for another hour after that. It was my first time ever having a marathon chat session with anyone. I was used to exchanging just a few words with someone before retreating back into my introvert cave. It felt thrilling to have such a deep and spontaneous conversation. Lisa and I had a few more of these all-nighters as we kept in touch with each other for the 3 months she was on the road. All the while, we planned when we would be able to see each other again. Finally, the day came when the circus was back in town. Lisa and I had already set a day when we would meet up for lunch. I was nervous to meet up with Lisa again, but mostly I was excited. I already knew she liked me, and we had plenty in common. I assured myself that I had nothing to worry about. We would meet, take things one step at a time, and see where it led us. I picked out a pizza place where we could meet for lunch, but when we arrived, Lisa told me she wasn't actually hungry. She ended up just ordering a water and watching me eat a few slices of pizza. And though she said it was fine, I couldn't help but feel as though she were anxiously waiting for me to finish so that we could leave. It wasn't quite the pleasant lunch meeting I was anticipating. After finishing my meal, the two of us took a walk together uptown. We chatted about our lives and what our future plans were. It felt as if we were having another of our all-nighter chat sessions. Before we knew it, we were deep in the heart of the city, and Lisa asked to make a pit stop at a coffee shop. As we sat down with our drinks, the topic of dating came up. Lisa started talking about how being on the road when you're single can be tough. She added that it was tough to know sometimes whether meeting with a guy was actually a date or not. This caught me a bit off guard. I felt as if the statement was an indirect question about our current outing. Surely Lisa knew that our plans for lunch and a private stroll in the city was a date. Didn't she? I searched my mind for a response, but before I could come up with one, she continued. "What about you? Are you seeing anyone right now?" "Of course, I'm seeing you right now," is what I would have liked to say. Unfortunately, I was too floored by the initial shock of her asking the question. It would have been a perfectly innocent question, assuming, of course, that this meeting we were having wasn't a date. I started to second-guess myself. I thought back to the pages of chat logs we had between the two of us. Never once was the mention of dating brought up. But what else were we doing if not going on a date? Still in a haze of nervous confusion and astonished bewilderment, I simply responded that no, I didn't have a girlfriend, and yes, I too felt it was difficult to tell when a date is actually a date. Lisa seemed totally unfazed by the exchange. I was still paralyzed with perplexity. Shortly after this exchange, Lisa received a call from someone at the circus and said she needed to head back. I nodded. I asked if we would have a chance to see each other again, and she invited me to visit the circus to see the show. I said that I would. And as we texted back and forth to set up the plan, I decided to take what Lisa said about dating into consideration. This time, I resolved to make it very clear it was a date, to avoid any confusion. When the plan was set, I texted her, "So, I guess we can call this a date?" I figured she would appreciate my honesty and wit. However, her response nonchalantly stated, "Well, it will be more like a backstage tour." I read this over a few times, and a few things became very clear to me. One, Lisa did not find my question amusing. Two, Lisa did not consider whatever it was we were doing dating. And three, my seeing her at the circus was also, most assuredly, not a date. I recalled back to the many times in the past I felt myself falling into the nice guy pit of confusion and despair, or, as some would call it, the friend zone. You strike up a good rapport with a woman, think everything is going really well, ask her on what you believe is a second or third date, and then find out that she never once thought of you as a potential relationship partner. I don't know how Lisa had been feeling all this time, but it seemed as though, if there was ever a chance for us to start dating, that window was now closed shut. I met Lisa at the circus the next evening. It was a fun show, but it was difficult to focus on it. The whole while, I had been contemplating what my status with Lisa was. Was it really over between us? Was there nothing there to begin with? What about our nights chatting until 3 in the morning? Did she see me as just a friend the whole while? Did I say something to upset her? Before I knew it, the show was over. I sat in my seat, waiting for Lisa to finish her work before meeting with me afterwards. She showed me around backstage, as promised, and we talked about the show. I was still in a bit of a haze. "How did you like the trapeze act?" she asked me. Again, flying trapeze was never really my can of beans. Between that and the fact that I had been focusing more on her than the actual show, I wasn't able to form much of an opinion about the act. "Oh, yeah, it was pretty good," I responded, trying to stay present. Lisa's face shifted to a scowl. "Ah, pretty good," she said, clearly disappointed in my response. "Right, you're a trapeze guy. You've probably seen hundreds of better ones," Lisa continued passive-aggressively. I'd forgotten that she had good friends in the trapeze act. I knew that she felt a sense of pride in the whole thing. I most certainly came across as an unenthusiastic, flying trapeze prude, nitpicking every detail of the act. I tried to recover from my clear blunder, but my mind was still a jumble of emotions. "Oh, well, I didn't think it was bad. I liked it. It was good," I spat out, stumbling over my own words. But I could clearly see that the final nail was already driven firmly into its coffin. I could almost read the words, "We're done," on Lisa's face. I let out a mournful sigh and accepted my judgment. Lisa and I did not speak again after that night. I was not at all surprised by her lack of any further Facebook messages or texts. I'm not sure exactly what it was I did or said that changed her mind about me, but it was clear when the decision was made. I had no choice but to take it for what it was. I figured it was probably for the best. There wasn't much of a relationship for us to have, given her travel schedule. Still, I couldn't help but blame myself for messing things up with her. I was so sure I did something completely unforgivable to make her decide she wasn't interested, yet I still had no idea what it was. I wish there was a more obvious lesson to draw from the experience. Unfortunately, All I really learned was never assume it's a date. The story ends there. Stay tuned next week for a thorough breakdown of the story and what can be learned from it. But now is your chance to send me your thoughts and questions so I can address them in the next episode. Lovely. But that's it for this episode of Romeo, and as always, if you have a story you want featured on the podcast, send me a message via email, contact@stsaint.com, or give me a call, 516-514-7878. Also, be sure to follow me on social media, like Romeo and on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter @street_saint. New episodes of Romeo and are published weekly, so make sure you get every episode when it's released by subscribing to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcatcher of your choice. But if you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. There's nothing more valuable for the show than getting a bunch of good ratings from all of you guys. Thanks again for listening. I am Street Saint, and I'll see you next time.